Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 248.
We're back on schedule?
We're back on schedule.
Sort of.
We had this
closing in on 250.
This is a big comics week.
Yeah, it is.
And so, like, I think we all had to power through a little bit. I managed to get everything read, just barely. I think Dave's not going to just read everything he would have liked.
Nope.
Nick, you didn't get a chance to read everything you would have liked?
No, actually, I did finish everything.
Okay, so it's a good comics week for me. This is one of my best weeks in a while, so there's a lot of stuff that could potentially be picked, and it is, in fact, one of those weeks when we have a group pick on top of our other picks.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, everybody agrees,
a third
which means
pick.
That if you don't buy it, we will cry.
It's true. And yeah, as we are coming up to 250, the special thing we're going to do for that, we're in the works. We'll see what happens.
Yes.
I'm not going to promise anything. You underpromise and overdeliver. That's what Scotty taught me.
What if we go and make one promise, Randy? Yeah. Fireworks. An amazing display of fireworks.
Yes.
For the podcast.
There will be...
You're talking about digital fireworks, right?
No. Real fireworks.
Everywhere.
Like, it's going to be amazing.
It's going to be everywhere. It will be...
Whoever's listening to the podcast at that time will see fireworks wherever they are?
No, not at that time. That's the thing.
We're going to do the fireworks here. We'll probably describe them.
Well, no, it's going to take us some time to set it up. So it's not going to be right with the 250th. It is going to be right around July 4th, coincidentally. But if you go outside anywhere on July 4th, you will see fireworks. And those fireworks are for Roguecast 250.
That's right.
So just remember that. And if you happen to be looking at fireworks on July 4th, just email us, I saw the Rogues fireworks. all right. That is a hilarious running joke to me and Russell Sinclair, who's emailing us every time. That is
true.
Only people making that joke, but I'm going to keep making it. All right. We've got a bunch of store news coming up. I'm not going to run through all the specifics, but the summer is coming. We are in a spring break right now, and there's... Summer is coming. Yes.
It's like the anti-White Walkers.
Yeah, I am an anti-White Walker. I'm excited. I love the summer.
The Tan Walkers.
We have our Magic the Gathering War of the Spark pre-release is coming up Saturday, April 27th and Sunday, April 28th. You can sign up for that now. Coming down the pike in May and June and July, we've got Free Comic Book Day, International Tabletop Day, Free RPG Day. We're going to be at Greater Austin Comic Con this year. There's already another Magic pre-release in July. And, of course, our All Ages Awesomeness will be coming out. So, a lot of stuff coming up. We'll have specifics.
I forget, this is that time of year where we have no life.
Yeah, it's coming to that time. So be kind to us when you see us at the store. All right, we've also got a huge backlog of news, and we're going to go through it, and I'm going to cherry pick as I go. So probably the biggest news is that James Gunn has been rehired for Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Yep. I'm going to guess most people know that because it was like a shot heard around the world on Facebook and other social media.
I was going to say, every single one of my friends who have any tangential love of comics or the MCU was posting it.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like the bad people who tried to essentially frame him up with it for political reasons,
yep,
in their face... it's good for Guardians. I think he's still going to do Suicide Squad as well.
I believe so.
Suicide Squad is first.
So that gets, that's, you know, that still gets to be, you know, DC gets their cool James Gunn movie.
Yep.
Downsides here? And maybe we've all learned a little bit of a lesson about not freaking out a little bit when somebody shows contrition over something that was in their past.
No, we've definitely not learned that lesson.
All right, but like maybe like on some level it's at least a case of forgiveness.
Yeah, which is nice.
Yeah. Now, I want to say that... almost certainly tied up in the financial benefits that James Gunn offered Disney. I don't think that they're all just like, we thought it over, and we really just thought about it a lot. But anyway,
I mean,
I think it's a case where a good thing happened.
No. Well,
I don't think they were beholden to do it.
A lot of it was Alan Horn, apparently, who's one of the big guys at Disney, and I believe he was a former Warner guy, and he was the one who, I don't know if he was like deeply offended by the tweets, or if he maybe leans a little rightward, and he was like, trying to get in good with these right-wing trolls. Yeah. At any rate, he had basically said, you know, he talked with James Gunn, and he appreciated it, but he couldn't, in good conscience or whatever, hire him on, and apparently changed his mind. Possibly it was that kind of like, when you break up with someone and then you see them going out with someone else, you're like, I want them back. And when he saw him doing So Suicide Squad 2, and realized, oh, that guy's going to make a lot of money for the rival studio. Maybe that's when he decided, hey, let's get him back.
The James Gunn was greener on the other side?
Yeah. the things I'm excited about, first of all, I'm excited we're going to get Guardians 3. I was okay with it if we never got it. Like, they had a good enough send-off in Avengers Infinity War. But
completely,
it was a disruption in the massive and very successful Marvel plan.
Yeah, I wanted that. I want a Volume 3 of the Awesome Mix.
Yep, and it's just, more cool space exploration and, like, expansion of the Marvel Cosmic Universe.
And I want James Gunn involved in the going forward, the brain trust that runs Marvel, the MCU. Because... Right.
Did he write the Guardian stuff?
He was at least involved.
Infinity War?
You can tell when Gunn's voice is in there. It's kind of like, you know, the Russo brothers, if they're not directing a movie, they're still, like, there in the brain trust. There's a group. I like that they have that group. And Ryan Coogler is involved whenever their Black Panther's involved. Like, I like that there's a brain trust of people who are like, bring their own voices and collaborate to create the MCU. That is the best of what comics do, and that's the best of what the MCU does.
Yep.
So I'm glad to have James Gunn back in the mix. I'm also excited he's going to be doing Suicide Squad 2. Maybe there'll finally be a DC movie I don't hate.
It's possible.
I don't think so.
I reached that point a long time ago.
I know.
Watch Aquaman, damn it.
I watched bits and pieces of Aquaman. It seems fine. It is not going to be the movie that wins me over. I already like Wonder Woman. I guess it's not hate, but love. There's not a DC movie I love. Yeah. And I they have not hit that threshold.
I think I may have loved Aquaman.
I think I might have. I do actually, like, even as I was watching it, I felt like the script is not, like, A-list throughout, but I felt, like, compelled and entertained throughout. Yeah. Like, it was a good kind of party movie that had a little bit of everything going on in it. Not quite on the standards of Thor Ragnarok,
no.
But it has, like... It has some of that vibe.
Yeah.
Mixture of, like, a bombastic metalhead action and then some comedy. But they also on Aquaman had, like, the Tomb Raider stuff,
I respect
too.
The movie that I can turn my brain off and just be entertained for 2.5 hours.
I do not respect those movies.
I don't know, Randy. You like Bumblebee.
I do like Bumblebee.
I'm just saying.
But again... It's the lowered expectations.
Yeah.
Bumblebee was after 5 Transformers movies. I was like, oh, this didn't suck.
Well, there's been a lot of DC movies you thought sucked. Maybe Aquaman might rock your world.
No, but maybe Suicide Squad 2. Well.
He's gonna aquatic rock your world.
The other big Marvel news is that they have found a director for Shang-Chi, which is apparently going full speed in development.
Yep.
That director is Destin Daniel Cretton, who I'm looking at his credits. And it's like short films and stuff. He's another sort of new guy.
This is the same thing that Marvel keeps doing.
With Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yep. I think it's a very smart thing to do.
Yeah, I agree.
Basically, just get a director.
As long as their talent picks, like as the talent choices work out. And that's the thing. It's like they clearly have been doing a good job of finding talent.
Yep.
Yeah. Whoever's doing that, if it's Kevin Feige or if it's just random...
Because it felt like pretty nerve-wracking when they first started doing it, like, oh, this guy has, like, 2 films under his name or a TV movie or whatever, and we're like, who knows? But there's clearly something that they see.
Well, I mean, the Russo brothers were all TV.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's,
and then they're the heads of some of their tentpole movies.
Yeah. They're basically the heads of Marvel who aren't Kevin Feige at this point.
It's true.
Yeah. What do you guys think we're going to see in a Shang-Chi movie? Like, action-adventure kind of thing?
It's one of those things where...
I think they're going to go the spy route.
Right, they should absolutely play up the spy route. So I haven't read much Shang-Chi. With all of these, you know, this includes, I've talked about, I think before, the Black Widow movie is not something that particularly interests me because in some ways it's as juvenile as her power set is low level. She doesn't have any super neato bad guys. I don't know what she would be doing that other cool spy movies haven't kind of done before. So what I need is a strong foot in the Marvel Universe. What I would like to see that for both of them. So if he's doing spy stuff, I want it to end up dealing with AIM. Or, you know, I want it to bring in some... The Red Ghost and his Super Apes. I don't care what it is. Whatever crazy thing they've got.
Well, I don't think Shang-Chi has a great rogues gallery either.
He does. He has Razor Fist.
Okay, average Marvel guy. I like Razor Fist.
Was that facetious?
That was facetious.
I like Razor Fist. I think he's got a good visual, but...
He has memorable... I mean, he was very much based on the Bruce Lee movie...
Enter the Dragon.
And his bad guys are, too. It's like the Razor Fist is straight out of that. I mean,
yeah.
It is... His bad guys are all based
Would
on
Would you lean
sort of that
into
kind of
that
thing.
Into
so
the
there's
MCU
been a,
version
There's been a ton, you know, 100,000 kung fu movies,
yeah.
and then the sort of heightened level things like wushu, you know, movies like wire fu stuff.
Yeah.
So you know, I guess that's one question is, do you go realistic, kind of like quasi-realistic martial arts, or do you kind of go fantasy, him running up walls and stuff?
I think you go crazy fantasy martial arts, because we've seen lots of realistic martial arts. Everybody does that in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Black Widow, Black Panther.
Yeah.
Black Hawkeye,
yep.
They all do it. I think that if you're gonna set him out as the greatest martial artist in the Marvel Universe, he needs to be doing crazy shit. This is why they failed with Iron Fist, really.
Mm.
So I think go crazy Wirefu. I also think since a lot of his supporting cast was British, it was like MI6, and they were really interesting characters. I would do Hong Kong. I would set it in Hong Kong
mm-hmm.
and deal with sort of the Chinese versus the British. And
which would
maybe
make sense with the diversification that we're seeing with Phase 4.
Yeah.
So.
And also, if you set it in Hong Kong, you get a massive overseas audience, which we know the studios care about.
Yeah, it's very true.
I'm really curious to see what they do with it. I think it's going to be interesting. Also, Nick, I will hereby admit, yes, the Black Widow movie is happening.
At least I got it on record.
Yes. What do you call it? Doctor Strange, where he trains with the Ancient One, is that in Tibet?
It's in Tibet.
I wonder if there's any way to
It's not.
Did they change that?
They changed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Did they decide to go something a little less politically volatile?
I think it's not Tibet because of
the audience.
I mean, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just wondering, if there would be a way to have a foot in that. Yeah. But that's interesting.
Anyway, while Marvel is firming up its Phase 4 plans, DC seems to be stumbling a little bit again. Because, Nick, you pointed me at this crazy Ezra Miller Flash stuff.
Well, I think this is having less to do with DC movies as proper and more with a kind of a clash between the directors and Ezra Miller himself, who basically the studio and the directors, who I forget their names, but
so
they're the guys.
John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, who
did
Game Night. And John Francis Daly is an actor who did. He was in a ton of stuff.
Did you guys see Game Night?
Yeah.
It's great.
It was fun.
I liked it more than that. And it made a lot of best of lists.
I think I was oversold on it.
That could happen.
When I watched it, I was like, "This is all right."
All right, we keep segueing away. Let's tell people what's happening.
But basically, they and the studio want to go in a more lighter, kind of more Aquaman fashion for Flash, and Ezra Miller wants to do a little bit of a darker take.
Right.
Who's
he co-writing with? Grant Morrison. He's co-writing it, right?
That's the deal. They basically were saying they were going to recast.
Yeah, they were just like, we're done with Ezra Miller.
Daly and Goldstein were going to do their version with Ezra Miller, and the studio is giving Ezra Miller one chance, like 2 weeks.
Yep.
To come up with a script that can prove that's proof of concept. That basically, I think, sounds like it may be they may lose this directing team.
Or they'll lose Ezra Miller.
Ezra Miller
is the one that they'll probably recast.
It's like, you know, Edward Norton, when he was doing Hulk, famously was a problem actor, and he wanted a lot of hands-on. But, at that point, Edward Norton was really somebody. He was one of the most promising actors there is. Ezra Miller, I don't think, is there.
I also don't think The Flash will be benefited by a darker story.
That's the thing. I kind of don't want him to succeed. No. I don't want a darker, and I don't care if Ezra Miller's The Flash.
I mean, I kind of appreciate that he's apparently got some passion for the character.
He does, and he went to Grant Morrison, or somehow Grant Morrison got involved, and he's writing the script with him, and I think that's awesome. I think, I'm kind of a horrible person for saying this, but I've never read Grant Morrison's Flash book that he wrote.
It was him and Miller, and it wasn't
a super long run, was it?
It wasn't his best. That was a 12-issue run.
Yeah.
I, of course, read his Flash in Justice League, and that was probably kind of the best version of it.
That is the crazy thing, that he went to Grant Morrison to do a script.
Because while I think Grant Morrison can be dark, I don't think that's his traditional mode for superheroes.
He does darker elements, and sometimes when people say dark, it may not be that dark. It may just be compared to, Guardians of the Galaxy, it's dark.
Right.
Aquaman
is not dark, but it had, dark moments and stuff in it.
So I could see, I will say this. If they make a standalone Flash movie, it probably needs a little bit of, some serious elements to hang its hat on to be dramatic. But overall, I want to say, the tone of the show is honestly kind of where I want it to be.
Yeah.
And this is a weird case of sort of rooting against Team Grant Morrison, only because I'm guessing the lighter direction they were looking for is probably what I would prefer seeing, even if Grant Morrison was informing the other side.
I mean, this does confirm a little bit that the, that DC is getting not doing a shared universe per se. Right. I mean, if they're going to go ahead and recast Flash and... I mean, they could do kind of this loosely. It's going to be a weird...
Yeah, like it sounds like what they're essentially do is a soft reboot, the way Bumblebee may or may not be. But, you know, Nick was reading up on that earlier, and it doesn't necessarily sound like they are going full bore back to the Michael Bay style either. It's just like they're going to use that to inform the action sequences or something. Okay. I don't know.
Well, good. The action sequences were the best part of those Michael Bay movies. They were so clear and easy to follow.
How would you like 2 hours of CG gears spinning around up close?
I thought you were talking about the Autobot gears. Spinning
around. It'd probably be better. Just breakdancing gears.
Yes.
Ezra Miller thing, it's interesting because it's weird.
It's weird.
Don't think I have, like, super high stakes in it.
Don't care if there's a Flash
movie. If he happens to somehow write a script that's so interesting with Grant Morrison that they decide to go with it, sure.
This is the first time he'll be writing a script, if I'm pretty sure.
Who?
Yeah.
Ezra Miller.
Oh, Ezra Miller. I don't know.
Morrison is definitely more versed in this.
I almost feel like he wouldn't be doing that if he hadn't, like, you know, written amateur scripts for, you know, a bunch of
stuff. Yeah, possible.
Here's something
interesting. Every actor thinks they're a writer.
Shazam premieres when? A week?
Soon.
I think it's 2 weeks.
Because what I'm wondering is, wouldn't that have an effect on the decision? If Shazam, which is definitely a lighthearted movie, does well, isn't that going to, like, make them want to steer more into the lighthearted style?
I honestly think this may be a foregone conclusion.
Is it just less about the movie and more about just whether or not he's going to be involved? Yeah. Like, they'd like to have him on board, but if he's, like, going to refuse to do it, if it's kind of lighter... Then they have to rehire.
And neither of you guys both saw him in Justice League. You liked him fine.
Yeah, it was fine.
He was good.
You don't care if he's Flash or not?
No.
It's not big. I actually, for continuity, like I actually liked his Flash quite a bit. I thought it was a good addition to it.
I'm not beholden to that.
I think that's gonna be the bigger issue. Like, a lot of people did not like the casting of Ezra Miller's Flash. And I think no one is like, Ezra Miller is my Flash. No one's gonna pick it a movie based on someone will.
I was going to say, have you not met
statistically statistically insignificant number of people will boycott the Flash.
The DC movies have not done their casting so well that people say, wow, it's, you know, for now and for all time, Robert Downey is Iron Man, you know, that kind of, what's his name, is Steve Rogers.
I have a feeling most people will feel that way about Momoa and Aquaman. I think he's solidified himself into that role.
Yeah, in a weird way, I think it's easier because Aquaman's more of a blank slate as far as people went.
That said, if they decided to cast Ryan Reynolds as Aquaman tomorrow, nobody would care. Nobody would complain that Momoa was gone.
That's possible.
Maybe.
Whereas, there's no one you could place Chris Evans with. Literally no one could play Cap instead of Chris Evans, so it'd make people happier. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, when there had only been one movie of Cap, if they could have done that.
Maybe.
I mean, obviously people took to him.
Yeah.
But you know, but when you've had a few movies, then you're gold.
Yeah.
Maybe at this point DC is just gonna be like,
Jason Momoa had played Cap as of the second Cap.
Oh my god.
Bro Cap.
God, that's the worst idea I've ever heard.
would have been right after his stint in Game of Thrones.
Captain Bromerica.
The worst thing I've ever heard in my life. I don't want to go to that universe.
That's what we got.
All right. So 20th Century Fox is releasing 6 Alien shorts to celebrate the 40th anniversary of that movie. In other news, I'm old.
These shorts are going to be released to the ether.
So they are being released weekly online by IGN and then being added to AlienUniverse.com and the Alien Anthology social media channels. I assume they'll put them on YouTube and that kind of stuff, too.
IGN, huh? It's a pretty big get for them, I guess.
This is the 40th anniversary?
Indeed. It's 1979.
Yeah.
So they describe the 6 shorts online. I don't recognize any of the writer directors. I don't know if these are all live action or animated. They're not really clear on that.
I assumed live action.
They must be. Which is interesting. I would rather have an animated alien thing.
I want live action.
Yeah.
I need to see humans.
Interesting. I just think if you're going to do something shorts, I feel like would be better in animation where you can really not have to worry about special effects budgets and that kind of thing. But I'm sure they're throwing money at this.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know that I need any more of the Alien universe.
Are these going to be tied in? Are these leading in any way to, like, the new TV series that they're talking about?
Nothing specific, no.
I actually kind of feel like, you know, in the same way that those like Animatrix, you know, shorts. They were essentially all shorts, and the same, almost the same for the comics that they did based on them. I think big aliens movies are all repetitive and boring to me now, and I kind of don't care about, you know, whether androids have feelings or not. But if you do like a 10 or 15 minute short or whatever, however that long they're going to be, that actually sounds like something where you could do something short and punchy and interesting, and probably, I actually think it weirdly is a better format. And I think TV could be best of all.
I think you're hitting on the right thing. It's like all the movies are the same. It's the same concept.
Yeah.
And I think we need to see it from a ground up.
Maybe we're going to see the daily life of a scientist who works doing bioengineering after they've got one. And he's all like telling his wife that they're working on a breakthrough, but what he's really doing is this super dangerous stuff. And you finally get to see the other side of Weyland Yutani.
He's really having an affair with the alien.
Maybe we'll see a POV of just the alien.
Yeah,
as a life cycle. I mean, through the face hugger.
Can you imagine if they did the sort of the equivalent of a GoPro on an alien?
Yeah,
you could potentially make something like
chest,
that work.
That would be freaky.
So, do you guys want to hear what the pitches are?
Yep.
Okay. Are they better all than right. what we were talking about?
I don't know. I didn't actually read them. Okay, so one is called Alien Alone. Hope, an abandoned crew member aboard the derelict chemical hauler Otantro, has spent a year trying to keep her ship and herself alive as both slowly fall apart. After discovering hidden cargo, she risks it all to power up the broken ship in search of human life. Alien containment. Four survivors find themselves aboard a small escape pod in deep space, and they start telling stories about what led to their ship's destruction. Alien harvest. Surviving crew of a damaged beast say, I'm seeing a lot of people in space. Missing space trucker and night shift, hardworking miner on alien ore, and night shift in a colony greenhouse, a botanist. So it sounds like all space worker people dealing with aliens.
Maybe? Possibly? I can't quite tell.
It doesn't
sound super inspired.
No, it does not.
Moving on to news of things that we sell. They announced a Talisman Kingdom Hearts edition coming out.
Yeah. Talisman being the old Games Workshop game that was, at a time when there were not a lot of fantasy board games, was one of the real notables.
Yeah, I think it's coming back into print, but again, I think they've raised the price, and I feel like a lot of gamers are not into that game as much anymore.
Right. It was, like I said, in those days, there wasn't a huge amount to choose from. Now the mechanics look, you know, kind of dusty, and it has that more of that feel of the randomness of American games than the kind of the slick mechanics
you
and interesting
Ameritrash
mechanics. Ameritrash, yeah. Than the slick mechanics of Euro games. That said, it is the kind of game that gets a lot of kids, I think, into gaming, or has the potential to. If it's like $100, I don't know, but Kingdom Hearts, I think, seems like a neat idea.
Yeah, combining it with Kingdom Hearts, which people love. People
so do you play,
Kingdom
like,
Hearts.
Sora and Donald
almost
and Goofy?
Sora and Goofy, yes. I hope
all
those are playable.
When you think about it, like, the way Talisman was very expandable, they'd even have additional boards. So they could be like, oh, this board is, you know, the Cinderella Land, this one is Arabian Nights stuff from Aladdin.
Yeah, I actually think it's a perfect
want
property.
Want your talisman game to last 12 hours?
Yes. If I had to guess, because I remember even with more recent editions, they've had alternate rules for brisker versions, and I bet this one they'll have something, they'll have thought of that even more so that you can have a game in just like an hour or two.
I think it's really smart. I mean, a Kingdom Hearts board game that is expandable makes a lot of sense. Tying it to a brand that people know is really good, and what other brands would fit? Like, Munchkin Kingdom Hearts would be a different vibe. Smash Up Kingdom Hearts would be a different vibe.
As I recall in Talisman, you basically got, like, an attack power, sort of a magic power, and your, like life power. Mm-hmm. And then you get gear and stuff, which could easily
be
Final Fantasy potions and elixirs and stuff like that.
It's a perfect match.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that'll do well. And they also traditionally always have great packaging and design on the Talisman games, so I'm sure all that amazing Kingdom Hearts art out there will go towards that.
The Renegade announced that they are doing a Wardlings RPG, which is based on that miniatures line that they have that's like kids and their animal companions, which I think we always thought would be a great game.
Yeah, for those who haven't seen it, it's also a pre-painted line.
Yes.
So it's like a, you know, it'll say like female rogue with badger, or, you know, male wizard with
rock creature.
With rock creature, yeah. They're all either little animals or little familiar type creatures and stuff.
Yeah.
They look really cool, and you can see them right over our Reaper section. There's probably, about 12 or 16 of them,
in that ballpark.
Yeah.
So they're going to get a formal RPG. Who's it from?
It's from Renegade, the guys who do Overlight and some of their stuff. Their stuff's all very pretty. That's a fifth. It's a D&D 5th edition game.
Oh, so, it is? Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure if they were going to do an original system or something like that.
It is D&D 5e.
And do we think it'll be like kind of an attempt to do an most all-ages friendly D&D?
It sounds like that is the goal, to do it sort of more kid-friendly, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, you could probably streamline some stuff and, you know, pare down a few rules or just remove some of the details, like maybe not have to worry about falling damage or something.
Right. And grappling. No grappling.
No grappling, ever. No, even when they say they've simplified it, no grappling.
No encumbrance.
Yeah.
No encumbrance, no grappling. Yeah.
And no rules for how fire spreads.
We've been talking a little bit about how Dark Horse has lost a lot of its licenses, and they just gained a new one. The Orville is going to have a 4-issue miniseries from Dark Horse.
That sounds fun.
Did they give a list of creators or anybody?
Yeah, we don't know much at all.
I'm actually finding myself quite excited about this, because I've gotten sucked into the TV series.
Me too. Season 2 has definitely won me over.
Season 2 has upped its game in ways that I didn't know Seth MacFarlane could.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know if that's Seth MacFarlane or if that's just the writers behind him
just doing
some interesting things.
I have not been able to catch Season 2, as I do not have that streaming service presently, but I told you so. just real quick to get that out of the way.
Yeah, no, I know.
This is one of those series, I think, that could, like so many licensed properties, it could be just mediocre or passable, or it actually could be really good. The quality of some of the recent Star Trek stuff leads me to hope that they could do a really good one.
Yeah,
I agree.
In fact, I actually think they could eventually one-up them, because I think sometimes the humor could stand to use a little to get turned up. or just be punched up a little bit. If you get the right writer, I think they could, you know, do some stuff even that the show hasn't quite been able to. Or just as a sense of humor that's a little bit beyond Seth MacFarlane's kind of standard wheelhouse.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm down to see that. Lots of fun characters on it. Little side places to explore. I mean, it's actually lots of room to play around in.
Nick, you also, I think, found this one, that Peter David and Dale Keown are doing another Incredible Hulk run. Not a run.
It's a miniseries.
It's a one-shot.
Oh, is it a one-shot?
It's an oversized one-shot. Bruce Banner is tired of being the Hulk, decides to call it quits, and a new opponent appears that brings him out of his lull. It is kind of weird to do a one-shot between these two guys. I wonder if it's something they were working on.
Well, isn't that what Hulk the End was?
Yeah, but this seems a little less, like, it's not quite as apocalyptic, maybe.
Yeah.
Although it's still kind of like, definitely like Peter David leans into the Hulk does not have a happy life. Bruce Banner has a dark life.
Peter David did give us like Mr. Fix-It and things like that, so he didn't have fun with his.
Oh, I mean, like he doesn't. No, almost no book he does fails to have some sort of humor in it, with the possible exception of Hulk the End.
Yeah, Hulk the End was very
grim dark.
Yes,
but good grim dark. I always liked it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I was more excited about this because I like Peter David. I like his run on the Hulk.
Yeah.
Seeing him paired with Dale Keown, which I know. I remember you being a big fan of Dale Keown's, right?
I'm not like an uber fan.
Right. But
maybe we can buy 100,000 copies of this, and when people come in and occasionally ask us if Pitt is still around, we can just hand them this and be like, yeah, he's green now.
He's green now.
Right, I forgot Dale Keown was Pitt.
Yep. Dale Keown famously was like a musician.
That's right.
Would go off.
I was thinking of somebody else.
He would go off and do his band, and then when he needed money, he would come back and draw an issue of Pitt.
Yep.
Hey, I have a Pitt.
Whereas, say, who was the other Hulk artist who is...
Gary Frank?
Gary Frank, yeah, yes. who's been very prolific.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary Frank actually wrote and drew his own book, Kin, and all that kind of stuff.
So much so that he may be drawing one of DC's biggest books right now.
Finally, I think we're all excited about this. Justice League and Black Hammer are doing a crossover this summer.
Yeah, Jeff Lemire's Black Hammer series for Dark Horse, one of their notable things that is still in their library. Crossing over to Justice League, I can only assume they will be there to teach the Justice League how to swear profusely.
Well, I think the cover showed the Justice League in the town. And I believe the Black Hammer character is in Metropolis.
Yeah, so...
Oh, wow.
So what we know... Yeah, the cover has... Yeah, it is swapped them. It is a 5-issue miniseries. Jeff Lemire is writing. Artist is Michael Walsh, who I don't know who that is.
He tends to work with good artists.
What we know is that a strange man arrives simultaneously on the Black Hammer farm and in Superman's Metropolis.
Makes it pitiful.
Both worlds are warped, and DC villain Starro launches an attack.
Okay. I'm interested in all that stuff.
Yeah.
It is weird to have these characters who are made up of analogs that are partially Marvel and partially DC.
Yeah.
Meeting the DC characters.
But I would like to see Colonel Weird meet Adam Strange.
Yeah, yeah, it has to happen.
That'd be awesome. That'd be so good.
It'll be the Colonel Weird Thanagar War.
All right. That's it for news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics.
One familiar cry. Rogue Cast.
We're talking comics for the Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. Again, it's a big week, and we're starting off with one of those things we do occasionally. All three of us are picking one book this week.
A mega pick.
And that book is Spider-Man Life Story number 1, the 60s.
I remember when they first solicited this, I was quite excited just by the cover alone.
Yeah. The cover, is Zdarsky's cover.
Is it? It looked almost like Tim Sale.
So there's variant covers by Marcus Martin, Greg Smallwood, and Scotty Young, but the main cover is Chip Zdarsky.
And it's a beautiful cover.
It's a great
Spider-Man
design.
Is swinging on 60s-era military helicopters as they flash by. Really nice use of negative space.
Well, you're right, Dave. I mean, it is very comparable to, like, Tim Sale or Michael Cho or something like that. Marcus Martin. It kind of gives
because
that
Because of the
feel.
Ink wash, it really reminded me of Tim Sale's work on the... The whole gray, Spider-Man blue and all that.
It's an amazingly striking cover.
And for those who don't know, the basic premise to this Spider-Man was like... it's as if his origin occurred in 62 when the character was created, and then the series will proceed to move forward with him aging and as the decades pass in real time for that. And we will. The idea is to like really portray a life of Spider-Man over the course of how many issues?
I believe it's 5.
Okay. And are they roughly, we assume, like a decade an issue?
Yeah, they're a decade an issue. Next one is the 70s. And the interesting thing is, not only is it Spider-Man, but it will be the whole Marvel Universe moving forward. Now, it is focused on Spidey, but he is not the only Marvel hero who shows up in here.
Yeah, decidedly, notably mentioned would be characters like Captain America, Iron Man.
That's it.
Is it just those? Okay.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this is that this being the first one, feels the closest to a regular Spidey book, because it is Spidey in the 60s, he's in college, it's him and Gwen, it's him and Norman Osborn, it's the Miles Warren makes an appearance, and it feels like this could be almost a lost, like, 1960s comic.
Yeah.
Right, or just a retelling with Peter, Peter Begley? Mark Begley. I can't say his name.
But there's a particular focus on
the war.
Vietnam.
Yeah.
That, like, What is happening when... Because, you know, Marvel Comics was coming out during Vietnam, but they didn't touch anything on that, really.
Right, the closest they had is something that does play a role in this, which is Flash Thompson did kind of mature from being a bully and go off and fight in Vietnam. And here, it's a somewhat more contentious thing with some more... somewhat more honest emotions than they were probably going to be comfortable with writing about in the 60s, and even in subsequent years when they would kind of slightly retcon it or whatever.
Well, the confrontation and the sort of resolution we get between Peter and Flash is probably my favorite moment in the comic.
That's really good.
It's just, like, very human and very real, and I don't know, it kind of
It's the
shows...
emotional fulcrum of the issue.
Yeah.
There's also, it's classic Spidey. I mean, I love the way that Zdarsky writes Gwen, the way he writes Harry, the way he writes Norman, the way he writes JJ.
What's interesting is that Peter's with great power comes great responsibility is put to a severe test in this by making this real world thing where he's like, should I go to Vietnam? He's like, I don't know if I agree with this war. He's like, or am I just telling that because I'm like, I can't, I'm kind of too cowardly. And then there's, like, side stories you hear about it, like, where there's people are trying to pressure Captain America to go.
Yeah, or we see Iron Man actually in Vietnam, like, saving people.
As a hero, because that's, he's a warmonger at that point.
But yeah, like, and there's sort of some moral grayness throughout. You know, what's interesting is that there is that moral grayness, and yet it still feels like a classic Marvel comic.
I mean, it does have the trappings. It does have, like, one of Spider-Man's villains.
There's a pretty tense scene with one of the villains.
Oh, yeah. It's
I was like, this is an actual scary moment.
Yeah.
That's really well done, too.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, I like how it sort of diverges from, like, traditional Marvel continuity. Yeah.
By kind of having, this has both the advantage of that 20/20 hindsight, which you can kind of look back and pick and choose the elements you want to weave in there, but it's also like, you can touch on hotter political topics now than you would have been allowed to at other times, mm-hmm. and make some decisions. Like, you know, it also seems, I don't know if we'll see this throughout the course of the book, but like, it seems like Pete is probably going to change. I imagine he's going to try and make each era feel like that era. Like the 80s is going to be the black costume and stuff like that. And maybe, you know, slightly edgier Peter Parker. But it'll also be a Parker who will now be 20 years older than
this.
It'd
be interesting if 40-year-old Parker needs the boost that the symbiote gives him to actually be an effective Spider-Man.
I can totally see that.
Touch on sort of performance-enhancing drugs,
otherwise,
all that kind of stuff.
How is he going to take on the Puma?
Yes.
I hope.
Yes. Oh, my God. I would have liked this as just a one-shot. If this was all it was, I'd have been super happy about it. Like, it's an interesting thought experiment. But without giving too much away, going forward, seeing how the Marvel Universe changes from taking a more real-world approach and seeing Spidey age, I am fascinated by this, and I kind of want it to be bigger. Like, I want more of the Marvel Universe.
Yep. Be careful, Randy. We'll get all these side stories by lesser writers
I know,
and stuff like
I know.
That. So right now... what I would like is for this to be a success, and then if it remains as good, for Zdarsky to be able to go back and play around with the timeline or show other characters as they go throughout this.
Yeah.
But when this was first announced, I think we all had some enthusiasm for it. It sounded like a neat idea, and we're like, well, if it comes off well, then it could be really cool.
And it comes off really well.
Yes, it does.
I think the only minor gripe we might all have is that Mark Bagley is actually a really good fit for this. I mean, it wants
talented.
More like classic Spidey, but... I think we were looking for a little more, like, we want, like, a stylized, like, a Michael Cho or...
Chris Samney, one of those,
That said, as we have learned numerous times, our taste in sort of more esoteric artists does not model the most of the industry, and I feel like it wouldn't be as successful if it had a more stylistic art.
Right.
Probably true.
So I think they probably made the right decision, and Bagley's art here is really good.
It is very good.
And he's got a connection with Spider-Man, too. I mean, he's got 150 issues. But still, I think if you're a Spider-Man fan, you have to check it out.
Oh, yeah, must have. For me, my pick this week, my first pick, is Lazarus Risen, number one. This is the return of the series Lazarus that Greg Rucka and Michael Lark have done. It's sort of a dystopian future. It is year X plus 68, because Rucka wisely does not want to tell... what year this goes forward, so his stuff doesn't look dated in 20 years.
Right, so the X is, it's what did you say, 68?
68 years since the...
Since whatever changed everything.
Yeah, so basically there's a whole bunch of families. We've talked about this in the podcast before, but basically, in short, there are 16 families that sign the Macau Accords. They divide the world amongst themselves. People who provide a service to those families are called serfs. All others are called wastes. And every family is a champion, the embodiment of their technical and martial power, called a Lazarus. And this focuses on Forever Carlyle, the Lazarus of the Carlyle family, which is known for genetic engineering. Specifically, they do the food supply for this world. There's a lot of intrigue among the family. It's very Games of Thrones-ish. And as we get back in, there is, first of all, a Dramatis Personae page, which tells you who all the characters are. There is a two-page previously on that gives you a rundown of everything, which I found very useful. And then it jumps into a daring military raid with political consequences, which is kind of what Lazarus does well.
Michael Lark's art, I was just flipping through it, and it was, like, stunning how good his art is.
The art's fantastic. This picks up nicely. If you were a Lazarus fan, this picks up all the plot threads. If you weren't a Lazarus fan, I actually think you could jump into this, because the write-up is so good, and you could read this issue, and if you wind up liking it, you can go through, pick up on the trades, and catch up on what you missed. But it's really good. Lark does some... super good silent storytelling here with the action sequences. There's some nice tense stuff between the political maneuvering. There's a side story going on with another character that maybe is like being prepped to replace our lead character. There's a lot of really great character stuff going on, and as always, it is spectacularly beautiful. There's also, this is a nice package. It's got a piece of fiction by Lila Sturgis in the back that is set in this world. There is a there's a bit of, since they just released the World of Lazarus for the modern age RPG, there is a character write-up for one of the characters for that role RPG, and then there's some rules for drones in that world. So if you're at all Lazarus fan, you'll be happy to have this back. It is really, really good, and I had forgotten how much I love Lazarus, as I always do. And then every time it comes out, I'm reminded this is one of my favorite books.
Yep.
So I highly recommend it, especially if you have a fondness for dystopian, nightmarish fiction.
Yeah, yeah. It's it can be cathartic to read about the world we're on the cusp of in its weird, dark way.
Yes. Nick?
I am picking another number one. Mine is Dungeons & Dragons, A Darkened Wish, which I was excited about when it got solicited. Mm-hmm. And I am...
First new D&D writer was it IDW?
Yep.
In a while.
Yeah,
we've all liked Jim Zub.
Yep. Yeah.
But he definitely, he got a good run.
And this one is written by B. Dave Walters and art by Tess Fowler, of Rat Queen's fame.
Right. She's drawn medieval fantasy.
She's drawn it before. She draws it again, and she draws it stellarly. Mm-hmm. I mean, but this is sort of an interesting tale because it's broken up into sort of two eras. There is a basically telling a group of kids who are kind of moving away from their lives and their towns to sort of join a faction. Yep. And then it's kind of
their adult selves.
And then their adult selves in the second part of the story.
Their epic level selves was interesting because the character sheet variant has the second level character, and then the back is the 20th level.
And like all of them have the epic level ones, but not
all. It's super cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're getting two halves of their lives told in one. Dave is not wrong. It is very much the It of the D&D world.
Yeah, Stephen King's It.
There is a dark force that their adult selves are having to deal with that may take a part of what has happened as kids.
Yeah. I actually didn't particularly notice anything as I was reading it that felt like derivative of it
other than structure.
Have written stories of adults and kids together, and then this happens to do that.
But I haven't seen it like done in like the D&D setting, and I actually thought that was it's a good usage of it. I love that they also use some otter characters. There's a character in here that's a Kinku.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very
neat.
The
Kenku is so good. I like that character so much.
They play with the thing that the Kenkus do where they like parrot back what they hear and they use it in an interesting way.
There are a pair of twins who are like clerics.
Yeah, and they're definitely, I mean, they're not elves. Aren't they? They do have the elves.
They might be elves, but they definitely play with sort of a more unusual party of characters. And I think that each one of these characters is very, like, I like the Jim Sub stuff.
Yeah.
But his characters, other than Minskindu, are not as memorable to me.
Like, right.
I'm not attached to them. I was instantly attached to each of these characters, and I thought all of them did a good job establishing who they all were.
It's set in a slightly more unusual place than the Waterdeeps and Baldur's Gates of the world. It's in the Moonshae Isles. Which I remember books and stuff about them back in the day, but it never quite grabbed me.
It's
sort of
their Celtic setting.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know much about it, but like it's... It's got both its own flavor in this, as well as traditional D&D elements.
Yeah, I know nothing about the Moonshae Isles. I guess I'm going to learn, and it certainly wasn't a hindrance for me enjoying the book, because I kind of just fell in love with the characters and the overarching story, and I'm curious to see where their adventure takes them.
Yeah, same. I was very pleased with this. I think it's the best D&D comic in a while, and I've been enjoying the Jim Zub stuff.
And I think the writing is very good. I also have to tip the hat to Tess Fowler, who sort of endears the characters to you because of sort of the character emotions that she's getting on their faces and sort of the interactions. It feels more livelier because of it.
Her world feels very lived in, which is one of the things I like. You know, those cityscapes and stuff like that feel populated and dirty and filled with people and, you know, there's beautiful things and then dirty things and stuff like that. It's got kind of a tactile feel to it, I want to say.
So yeah, if you're a D&D fan, I would definitely recommend. Dave, what do you pick?
I'm all about the issue number threes, unlike you number one chumps. This is the third issue of from Brian Bendis and what's his name?
David Walker.
Naomi from DC. Naomi was an original character, teenage girl. Grown up in a small town in the... I forget, was it like Northwest or...?
I think it is specifically Northwest, because that's where Bendis is.
Yeah. Who has a mystery involved... She's adopted, and
Superman visits their town and sort of...
He's a catalyst for, like, these questions about her backstory of something that happened, something else that... It was like, people were like, oh, that's the one big thing that's ever happened in our town. Superman had a fight here and came back and helped rebuild... And then there's like, oh, but there seems to be something that was maybe covered up like 16 years ago, like coincidentally right around the time she was born. So for the last few issues, she's been digging into it. And there was a little bit of, it felt a little spinning of wheels for in the last issue, even though it was all interesting, really beautifully drawn by whoever this artist is.
Naomi Campbell.
Jamal Campbell, not the model Naomi Campbell.
That's true.
She could draw.
It's possible.
I'm just going to say, they very quickly in this one get to some big answers in it, and the answers I thought were really satisfying. I think we both liked them, right?
Yeah, very much. This could have been my pick as well.
There's a guy who, like, runs a garage, who's this big, burly, tattooed guy, who, in the previous issue, he seems very kind of, like, depressed almost. Like, he's sort of this, almost more of a gentle giant type guy. And she definitely knows that he knows something about her origin. And the obvious thing is sort of like, is this guy my biological father? The age is possible. And she goes and looks into it, and I will simply say they do not go with the obvious thing, and the explanations have ties to the DC Universe. And mention, I want to say, at least three notable DC things over the course of it.
It's funny.
All of which were interesting.
I went off this book, but you guys telling me a little about this makes me want to go back and check it out again.
Yeah, it was. It's interesting because it's very much Bendis doing what he does with it, which is an emotional story, what I find when I like him best. Actually, Bendis does a lot of... Bendis doing what he does is oftentimes something I don't like. In this case, it's one of the things that I do like, which is telling an emotionally compelling story about a small group of characters. I think that's when he's best, when he's a little focused like that. And... a story that has its roots in something that anybody could feel, you know, losses of loved ones, adoption, trying to figure out who you are, you know, they're kind of some
baseline stuff. But on a scale that is the DC Universe.
It's got to be on a scale that is the DC Universe. Anything else I would say would be spoilery, so I will not get into it. I thought this was a very satisfying issue.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
Backup pick is another number three. That is my theme. Criminal number three. This concludes the story arc of a guy who it's told from the perspective of an inking assistant.
Yeah, it's another one where he's going a little meta into the world of comics.
Yeah, this is a dude who is an inking assistant for sort of one of those living legend type creators, and they had he has a love hate relationship where there was hero worship for the old man, but the guy is also like a bastard and he's harsh critic on people. He has so many negative qualities. He absolutely feels like a realistic portrayal of the shattered dreams of your hero. And yet the lead character has not been able to walk away from him. And when he's taxed by the guy's agent to kind of deliver him to a comic convention to accept the equivalent of a lifetime achievement award, he ends up getting involved in a criminal heist with him, which in this case brings in a career criminal too. He himself, the lead, has he's broken the law before, but not to the degree that the career criminal that they bring in from other criminal stories. What's his name? Lawless.
Ricky Lawless.
Ricky Lawless.
Who was the lead in one of the later ones?
Was it the later one?
His father, Teague Lawless, was the second volume of
Criminal. Right.
And by the way, there's a letter column. They reveal the protagonist of this. Which I had not caught this, is actually a notable character from another criminal arc as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, yeah, the heist itself is super interesting. It goes, there's ups and downs to it, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
It's not one of those, everything hits the fan. It actually kind of goes a little awry in interesting ways. And then there are some very interesting emotional beats that happen before the end of the issue. It's noir to the bone, which is what Brubaker does. But the thing he always does that I appreciate is he remembers that there's a living, pulsing characters underneath this. It's not just, I want to tell a story that the world is sad and dark. His world is kind of sad and dark. Mm-hmm. But it's told through the eyes of some really interesting characters. And there's some stuff that happens at the comic convention as well. I was kind of enthralled throughout it. I don't know, his portrayal of characters, it feels like this could have been something that really happened.
It does feel very real. One of the things I really like about this is a two-part story.
Yep.
And I'm all for shorter two-part stories.
Yep.
But it also, if you go back and read the rest of Criminal, I'm sure you would catch little references, little Easter eggs of other things that happened in the Criminal universe. Yeah. And also, this is not based on any... I mean, it is loosely based on real stuff, but Brubaker goes out of his way to say, hey, I'm not doing, like, a someone like in the comics entry I know with the names taken off. He's like, there are stories about somebody doing this and somebody doing this. And so he's like, there are Easter eggs to comic book fandom, too. So it's like, there are levels you can read this. Like, you can read this on deeper levels. And you can read Criminal as a big tapestry, if you read all the graphic novels, of this big criminal underworld. Or you can read his standalone stories, and I think that's a really cool balancing act.
Yeah, yeah. The Brubaker may have, like, the best craftsmanship in storytelling of anybody in the comics industry. Yeah. Like, I really feel like he's refined and thought about how he controls the pacing of a story, how it all ties together, how much to show to make it work on its own, and yet also exist in a part of a larger tapestry, like you said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's super good. The only thing he doesn't really do is comedy.
No. Or superheroes. Honestly, his superhero stuff has never been that good.
With the maybe the exception of the supervillain book, Sleeper.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's Captain America.
Yeah.
But that was almost more of a espionage book with superhero tendencies. Yeah. Like, when he did
X-Men, should not have done X-Men.
X-Men was a bad fit. And we all knew that at the time. I think Brubaker knew it at the time.
Yeah. Because he probably had the opportunity. I can't blame him for trying.
No, absolutely.
Nick can because he killed off Banshee in that run, and Nick will never forgive him for that.
Forget.
Never forget. Ever. Not
never
ever.
Never forget.
And honestly, you're right, Nick. Yeah. All right, what else y'all got?
Yeah, it was St. Patrick's Day on Sunday. Never forget Banshee, the only Irish character in comics.
That's right.
And don't forget his daughter, Sirens.
Sirens. He's not the only Irish. I was being facetious. All right, Nick, what you got?
My backup pick, I think I may have picked a couple of these issues already, but it continues to be good, and that is Uncanny X-Men. This is number 14. This is a dark book. There's no way around that. The X-Men have been painted into, or the remaining X-Men, because most of them have been taken into some alternate dimension. Everyone thinks they're dead. The government has turned against mutants. They're hunted. Some are being thrown in internment camps, killed.
Just another day in the life of a mutant.
Scott Summers is back and trying to pick up the pieces of not only himself, but of the X-Men with the help from Wolverine. Along the way, he's built up this ragtag team of mutants who just so happen to be some of my favorites, so I'm kind of...
In the previous issue, they all geared up with some, like, essentially, like, spare uniforms and stuff they had that included, like, some of the looks from all these different eras of X-Men, but, like, so, notably, like, Cyclops' 90s
costume. Jim Lee, 90s. Yeah. It's kind of Wolverine. Fun. Basically, Wolverine went to the grounds of the mansion that's been destroyed and was able to grab a few things that were still around. So it's kind of this hodgepodge of suits. And Havoc, like, has his 2000s ones. I wish I really wanted him to have his giant...
The head disc is the best.
Yes, that one. But
as weird as it is, it's still somehow the best.
But this one sort of plays up... there is a character that I've loved who gets to a resurgence that may or may not offer the X-Men some help. There is a threat by way of Reaper, if anybody remembers the MLF...
Mutant Liberation Front.
...guy named Reaper. I think he ended up killing an X-Men long ago. No? he was kind of a no-namer. But
do you feel like he kind of is it a matter of like he's doing what you like with that character, or do they like rethink him, or
no they're doing something different with him, which I thought it's interesting. Matthew Rosenberg is
like a good comeback story for a lame-o character.
Exactly. But he's also using people like Chamber and Callisto and throwing the X-Men into Chernaya, which is like a fictional kind of country that has been overrun by this group of activists utilizing S.H.I.E.L.D. and Latverian technology. There's just some really, really cool stuff at work here, and I appreciate it because it's smart and feels like of X-Men of old, but doesn't shy away from continuity, because he's using some weird ideas.
Yeah.
And I think you have to... one of the weirdest is that several of the X-Men are infected with a warlock-type virus.
Huh.
And they're not quite themselves, but they are themselves, but they talk in sort of the self-friend vernacular.
Cyclops is looking very handsome these days. I'm just going to say it. He's looking he's looking good. 5 o'clock shadow's working for you, Scott.
And speaking of the artwork, this is Salvador La Roca, which he's super talented.
That's great.
And it's just... I think this is the best the X-Men has been, and I know Randy's looking going to look at me like
best
it's not
better. Been since ever?
Since a long time. I liked X-Men Gold, but I like this better.
You know, X-Men Gold as a touchstone seemed the biggest touchstone in that seemed to be the 1980s, and the biggest touchstone of this seems to be the 1990s. What
sort
did you
of.
Say? I feel like he's pulling from different eras, but like the 90s seems more present in it. So it may be ringing your bell a little bit more.
Maybe so, but I feel like...
I'm not saying that your nostalgia is the reason you're there.
No.
I don't think nostalgia was the reason that Randy was there for X-Men Gold.
Nostalgia had a heavy-handed, though. I think that's a lot of why I like X-Men Gold and why Uncanny didn't resonate for me is because the 90s X-Men is not my X-Men.
Yeah.
I do think that's to some extent. It does sound like what they're doing here is not what I want out of X-Men, but it is what a lot of people want. I know you and our buddy Cliff, who's a big, giant X-Men fan, are really digging it, so that's good. It's just a shame they had to kill Max Mingle to have it. They could have coexisted.
No,
that's what Xavier would have wanted. You're reading Magneto's comic.
Magneto was right.
No, that's not true. Xavier's dead and Cyclops is trying to atone for it.
See, that's exactly what Magneto wants. Xavier's dead.
I don't know what Magneto is. I think he's dead too, so it doesn't really matter.
Magento.
All right. My other pick is a Valiant comic. It is The Life and Death of Toyo Harada. Harada is like their big bad, but also like a weirdly, like a very nuanced bad guy.
So I'm trying to think, is he more of a Lex Luthor kind of thing?
He is the most powerful Psyad in the world. He was a kid when Hiroshima happened, and basically, as they show in the first like three pages here, when the bomb dropped, he was able to use a Psy shield and save himself, but he was like, his mother was like literally next to him and died. And so after that result, he decided that he was going to build the world better where that would not happen. And this jumps into him as a kid. Like a year later, he basically mind controls a Russian general. And he's been stealing everything from grain to tanks using his psychic powers. And he basically sets this general and he's like, go distribute all these resources to all the people of Japan. That's your job from now on. And just basically rewrites this guy's mind.
Hmm.
And that's the kind of thing Harada does. He's he uses his powers indiscriminately. He has massive telekinetic and telepathic powers, and he also used that to create a bunch of wealth, and he goes around activating other psyops, so he's basically like this, think Magneto plus Luthor.
Okay.
A little bit. In the modern Valiant universe, he has been, exposed. It opens with, like, Rising Spirit, which is like their anti-Harada. It's like the secret government organization. They created Bloodshot. They have figured out that Harada was trying to do this sort of world-creating thing, and so they are manipulating the world governments to think that he is basically trying to become a Psyop dictator, which is to some extent true, but it's the name of like
it's a whole organization dedicated to against him.
Yeah. there's a lot, the phrase anti-Harada is used a lot in here. Like, he is a massively powerful bad guy.
Right, they're talking about him as if he's an organization.
They've also, and he is an organization.
I mean, I guess he effectively is, yeah.
They've also done a book called Imperium that is set in the future that shows a sort of utopia where Harada has created in the future. So it is possible that that's what he's working toward. It's just that he's an ends justify the means kind of guy. So in this issue is basically these forces are coming after him as he's trying to build a space elevator up to the alien ring of technology in Valiant's universe to basically democratize this technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a big throwdown between fighter jets that are shielded against the psychic technology. He has an ally who's a member of the Hardcore who uses different abilities. He has an ally who's an alien. He has an ally who's kids who are psyops who he's used.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this big throwdown between all these creatures and powers and big epic superhero warfare, basically. And in the midst of all this, all these various characters, these aliens and robots and psyops, all have their own agendas and they're all working together, but they all are working on their own things. And it's just, it's a really fascinating look at sort of a super villains organization.
Mm-hmm.
When he actually has sort of noble goals. So think like Doctor Doom and that kind of stuff as well.
Right.
If Empire, that book that Mark Waid had done, that was like about a super villain who wins, if it had been a little more nuanced and a little less cartoonish villainy, it could have been this.
Right.
I really like this first issue. I think that, as with all things Valiant, I feel like there's enough stuff going on in Valiant that, and they're pretty tight on their continuity. They'd probably be better off doing a one-page, like, here's where things stand in the Valiant universe. Because I know that there was an alien invasion. I know there's a ring of alien technology, but here it's just kind of taken as a writ thing, like, oh, it's up here in space. And it might be that if you come into this and have not read any other Valiant, you might be like, huh, I don't know what all this means. Or you might read it just fine. I have no idea. It actually seems pretty approachable. But little things like having to explain what hardcore is and why this guy has to call into his operations guy to get powers sort of sent to him and that kind of thing. I feel like there's definitely a lot of assumption of you know the Valiant universe and reading, and that's probably its only flaw, but I still think it's worth reading because it's also got pretty spectacular art by Kafu. It is a kind of a thing I have not seen done in superhero comics before, and I think that's generally what Valiant's doing, is sort of a level of universe building and a level of realism that I don't think we see in superhero comics much, and I think this was a really good issue.
I've stumbled into some shared universe comics before, and I have to admit, there are times when the realizing something big has happened, like a, you know, alien invasion or something like that,
right,
is actually pretty exciting.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm like, oh man, it's kind of cool to see it through the aftermath, and actually the writers come up with some neat ideas. I want to go ahead and see what the alien invasion was now.
It's like when you were a kid and you jump into Marvel or DC and you're in the midst of, like, all this stuff that happened.
Right, which was all the time before the era of big story arcs and trade paperbacks.
Big story arcs. Is that like, it's like Big Gas and Big Pharma?
Yes.
All right, as I said, it's a big week, so other stuff on my list. Firefly Bad Company is a one-shot that goes into the backstory of Saffron. I actually really like this.
Yeah.
I thought this was a great rundown of who she was, how she came to be the sort of manipulative...
it was Christina Hendricks, right?
Christina Hendricks.
Her kind of first notable role.
Yep. I really like this. I thought it was a good one-shot. People who like Firefly will definitely want to check that out. And it ties in a little bit to the Firefly arc that Greg Pak is doing.
Oh, so, does it?
Yes. Sort of a character from there is in this.
Okay.
Savage Sword of Conan number 3 continues Conan versus Magical Snake Cult. Miles Morales Spider-Man number 4 is essentially a standalone story that is more or less Ferris Bueller's Day Off with Miles in the Ferris role. It works great. It's a lot of fun. Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 4 wraps up the initial story arc of Tom Taylor's run. I really like Tom Taylor. I really like what he's doing with Spidey. Spider-Man City at War number 1 is the first part of the adaptation of the video game. It's actually better than I thought it was going to be. I didn't know that I wanted to see a, like, all that story stuff turned into a comic.
Nah.
But if you haven't played the video game, it is a really good story, and I think this does a pretty good job of getting to the heart of it while skipping over all the action scenes, basically. Immortal Hulk number 15 is a Doc Samson-focused issue. It's really good, as always. Incursion number 2 is another Valiant book, whereas Toyo Harada is sort of one pillar of that universe. Incursion focused on the other pillar, which is the Dead Side, which is their sort of, like, their dark dimension, also where the dead go. The Eternal Warrior and the Geomancer, who is the person who, like, speaks for the Earth and that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So this is, like, the magic side, where Toyo is more the science fiction side. They're both really good. This is art by Doug Braithwaite, and it's pretty spectacular. Farmhand, the weird image book about body farming, sort of, comes back with number 6 with a new story arc. And there's a couple graphic novels I want to mention. There's a thing called Cretaceous from Oni that is a stunning... looks like mostly silent, except for some special effects, story of dinosaurs.
Shades of the Age of Reptiles that Dark Horse did back when.
Yep. It is really, really pretty. I definitely recommend it to anyone who has a fondness for dinosaurs. Crowded Volume 1, which I know me and I think all our female staffers really dig. It is a world where there are crowdfunded assassins and crowdfunded bodyguards, and a particularly obnoxious woman... has a particularly outsider bodyguard, and she's trying to keep her alive, even though she doesn't particularly like her. And it's a lot of fun. It is Midnight Run in a weird sci-fi universe, and I recommend it. If you don't know what Midnight Run is, it's a great movie. You should watch it. And finally,
nice oddball pitch.
Beasts of Burdens, Wise Dogs and Eldritch Men collects the new miniseries, and is the second collection of the Beasts of Burden, which is
cats dogs, and dogs,
supernatural cats and dogs.
Yeah.
With really, really pretty artwork. That's my stack. Nick, what else on your stack?
New book from G. Willow Wilson and Christian Ward called Invisible Kingdom, which sort of pits religion and corporate greed.
Industry, yeah.
Into the same kind of thing. Told through the eyes of a woman joining a nunnery and a space-traveling kind of... character. It was an interesting start. I thought it was a fun first issue with some cool things to say. Wolverine Infinity Watch number 2, which continues Loki and Wolverine's adventures in trying to find the Infinity Stones, who are now trapped inside human beings.
Okay, weird.
It's a little weird, but that sort of is kind of what this book is. They take a trip to Austin, if you can believe it. Eighth issue of Black Badge.
Wolverine takes a trip to Austin?
They all do. It takes place in Texas.
Neat.
Black Badge...
But he needs to get out. There's already too many people here for South by Southwest. Even you, Wolverine.
Have a good time, Wolverine. Don't move here.
Try telling that to Loki. Black Badge number 8, which sees kind of... the characters go on a little downtime back to their regular lives, and we get to see exactly if they've been telling the truth to their friends and what their lives really are like. There's also kind of other agency that are out to possibly get and kill them. So it's not a light story to be hit, but it continues to be fantastic. Batman 67 called All the Way Down, which is Tom King teaming back up with Lee Weeks.
It's like almost a full throwback to Batman Year One, right? I mean, it's like that is to say, Lee Weeks is doing Mazzucchelli's art style, and there's like even the tone of it, like it looks like an homage to Year One. I don't know what the story is.
A little bit,
but like, I feel like visually it couldn't be a more clear nod to it.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of Batman is stuck in his own head. Okay. And he's going through different nightmares, different parts of his brain. Mm-hmm. This one is sort of just a silent issue of him running, trying to catch a villain. That means going through various parts of Gotham, breaking through different buildings.
Does that mean, a.k.a. his own mind?
Yes, probably so. There's also another thing, kind of delving back into what Tom King and Lee Weeks has done previous to this together. Hmm. I don't want to spoil it because it's a lot of fun. Thor number 11, which is the issue right before the War of the Realms. It is all about basically Thor looking for Mjolnir in the sun, and Freya... basically,
we've all been there.
Admonishing him a little bit about you don't need that hammer to be the god that you are. So
moms will always give the nicest pep talks to their kids.
That's very true. It was actually kind of a touching story, which is kind of the reverse of what it was the last issue, which was all about Odin. Yeah. This one is all about Freya in a lot of ways.
Nice looking art. Who's doing it?
This is Dee Garbett, which is I was telling. I can't remember exactly, but the first thing I remember him from was Highwayman.
Yeah, and he's been doing some other stuff, too.
Yeah, he has. There's also some Jane Foster stuff in here. Balder shows up. Basically, if you're an Asgardian, you're going to be in War of the Realms, whether you like it or not. Third issue of Captain Marvel, which sees some kind of zigs and zags, and a stinger that I am excited to see, because it has a lot to... of what I like about Captain Marvel to begin with.
Is it a Flerkin?
It is not a Flerkin.
No!
But there's some exceptional artwork in here, and I really like Kelly Thompson's take on this kind of weird, segregated Captain Marvel in this weird universe that's... she's with her friends, but yeah, they're trying desperately to get out. Meet the Skrulls number 2, which if you didn't read Meet the Skrulls number 1, a.k.a. the Americans of the Marvel Universe.
The Americans via Skrulls, yeah. It was in one of our skip weeks, and it would have been my pick. I actually really liked it.
Yeah, honestly, this is a lot of fun. Basically, a family that are actually Skrulls, and seeing them sort of try to complete missions and things like that. It's the Americans, but told on the Marvel Universe scale, and I really, really like it. Not only that, but Nico Henrichsen's art is...
The art is phenomenal.
It's fantastic. But I kind of like the small lives of Skrulls and what they're doing to sort of infiltrate humans and try to overtake them. While at the same time, while somebody's trying to kill all the Skrulls on the planet.
Yep.
And then there's Avengers No Road Home, number 6, and I'll shut up, which is all about Conan joining into the Marvel Universe.
Yep, it's a Conan and Scarlet Witch road trip.
Which I was very much into.
Yeah,
I thought it was cool.
The very traditionalist pairing of Scarlet Witch and Conan.
Yes.
Well, how about a blind Scarlet Witch?
Yes.
I guess they found a twist on it.
Also, they're in Hyboria.
Yes. Dave, do you have anything else to add?
Just want to quick mention Guardians of the Galaxy 3, continuing Donny Cates' Guardians of the Galaxy. This one is kind of, there's two stories. There's the pursuit of the person, is it Gamora, who they
yeah.
think that is the now where Thanos's like spirit resides after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And Thanos's brother, why can't I say it? Eros,
Star Fox.
Has been leading a bunch of intergalactic Marvel characters like, you know, Gladiator from the Shi'ar Imperial Guard, Cosmic Ghost Rider and stuff to hunt her down and kill her under the presumption she's probably Thanos.
It'd be weird if it was the Daredevil villain version of Gladiator, like this the costume guy out in space.
He gets mixed up sometimes, right? He has his episodes and suddenly he's out there in space hunting down Gamora.
Yep, Space Taylor, Gladiator.
So that's half the story, which in this case also, by the way, includes a confrontation between Hela and Annihilus over the possession of Thanos' severed head.
That's cool.
And the return of Wraith, who was a kind of cool character in the Annihilation series.
Yep.
Peter Quill getting dragged kicking and screaming by Groot back into things.
Is he in his old Star-Lord costume?
I don't know.
That is his classic Star-Lord costume.
Okay.
That's the
yeah.
one he was first created in.
He don't want to like get dressed and get undrunk, and so Groot is like, yeah, I'm starting up the ship, we're going. Because Groot is like talking now and has like evolved in some interesting ways. Continues to be a book where I have, like, I sometimes don't agree with its general decisions, like, oh, that's not quite what I want from that character or from Marvel Cosmic or something like that, but consistently find it interestingly written and still compelling. So Donny Cates is pretty good at that thing. From Aftershock Comics comes a book called Dark Red. This is the first issue of it, and Tim Seeley, who we've enjoyed on horror outings like Hack Slash and
Revival.
Is the writer on this. So this is a vampire story, but before you go running, the kind of interesting thing is, like, this is a vampire story told from the perspective of a guy who cannot enjoy his vampirism. He is, like, working the, like, a shift at a crappy convenience store in, like small-town middle America, like, Trump country, and... It's just a sort of miserable life. There's actually a great scene early on where they're making him stay late on his night shift, and, you know, he's like, I really need to go. That's, you know, I told y'all when I hired, I have to go. And they're like, well, we can hire somebody else who can do the job. And he's like, okay. So he cleans up some spills. He gets out. As he's driving home, his skin is burning in the car because the sun is rising, of course, and he barely makes it inside before he is in a full-blown conflagration. Seeley has several other things going on at once. An interesting connection to a character who's got, like, a blood disease who willingly allows him to feed on her, like, in a, a platonic but friendly way.
Weird.
And then some twists and turns with people who seem to be hunting her. This has a very thought-out plot in it. It's not just a, well, we're going to do a slice of life about a small-town vampire. That would be interesting maybe, too, but that's not what this is. There is definitely going to be some twists and turns that kick it off, and I cannot tell where it's going to go. Hmm. But I thought it was a well-written first issue with an interesting lead character who is not what you would expect. He's not even just the sort of the normal schlub who just wishes he was anyplace else. There's a little bit more going on there. So, I'm going to suggest giving the first issue of Dark Red a try to people.
All right, that's it for Comics of the Week. We'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk about a couple of board games.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
Okay, real quick, I want to mention a couple of board games that I played this weekend. I know Dave played one of them with me.
Yep.
First is a new game called Call to Adventure, which is from Brotherwise Games, the guys who previously did Unearth and... Boss Monster.
I did not play this game, by the way, but this one sounds very up my alley. I want to play it.
Yeah, it's Brotherwise is 3 for 3 for me, and every game they make is completely different. Like, Boss Monster and Unearth are nothing alike. What they have in common is they perfectly, beautifully, visually fill their theme up. Like, Unearth is a very pretty game. It's about lost ruins. Boss Hunt's about 8-bit video games. It looks like 8-bit video games. Their gameplay is good. Their playtesting is clearly very good. They're easy to teach, but they have a little complexity to them.
Mm-hmm.
Very replayable games. And Call to Adventure is no exception. Its claim to fame is that they kickstarted it, and in doing it, there are a couple expansions coming that are... One is Mistborn, the Brandon Sanderson world, and one is the Call of the Wind, Name of the Wind, by Patrick Rothfuss. So they got some big fantasy worlds that are going to be expansions to this. But the main game, essentially what it is it's a card game where you are building a fantasy character. There are four people in the game, up to four.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 to 4 players. And basically you have these three eras of your life. One is sort of your early days. You start with a card that is your basic concept. So mine was a conscript. Somebody else was an outlander.
Mm-hmm.
From there, you do three cards that are sort of like growing up. You're buying them with these tokens and stuff. So you're like filling out your early life, and you do things like my guy found out he was secret royalty, and
do you get like is secret royalty like a higher point story point than like some other story point?
So
might
be? they all have things on them that are there's the six attributes, you know, like strength, dex, con, all that kind of thing, and then they have little
it'll
attributes
boost
like,
you up in some one of those,
and then there's things like a royalty symbol or a I think an arcane symbol and other stuff, and at the end of the game, if you have like. Every set of symbols you have, like I had three royalty symbols over the course of my adventure,
mm-hmm.
those are worth 8 points. And then I had, if you have a set of two of one symbol, you get a certain amount of points. If you have a set of three or four, you get points from that.
That sounds both like somewhat like card games and weirdly a little like Sushi Go.
Yeah, it's I mean,
but in a cool way.
You're collecting sets of cards,
yeah.
But they have this beautiful artwork on them that's like this fantasy world. And in the second one, you do more adventurous stuff. Like in my character went and. Became a criminal and then outwitted a gang boss and that kind of stuff. And then the third level is the big epic stuff. So my character, I failed at but tried to, like, overthrow the king. And then I destroyed an elemental and I climbed a colossus and I got that kind of stuff. And at the end of the game, you get points for all the things you did. The mechanic of how you buy things, there's these little rune, these little plastic runes that you throw.
Okay.
That essentially are the dice.
Yeah.
And you can add in runes. You can also add in, if you're feeling uncertain about your chances, you can throw in a dark rune. But if you do that, you might get more darkness. So there's like, on each character, there's a track that's
you mean
like,
more darkness like your character goes some evil direction
well,
or
there's,
something?
Think of it as like Light Side, Dark Side of Force, or like the Mass Effect Renegade Paragon stuff.
Yeah.
And there are cards that do that too, where you're sort of choosing, oh, I'm going to go the more noble path. And you have hero and anti-hero cards that give you bonuses. And if you get to a certain point that you're so heroic, you can't use the anti-hero cards. Or you go to a certain point, you're so dark, you can't use the hero cards. So there's a lot of little mechanics that go in. It's a very easy game to teach, but there's a lot of complexity to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, it's very beautifully produced. It seems like a game to be really easy to teach, and it's going to be very expandable. So I highly recommend this. This was super fun. It is competitive because there's a point score at the end. Whoever gets the highest points wins. But you're not, like, directly competing with the other players unless you're all trying to get the same story cards.
Right.
It's
competitive, but not super backstabby.
But not like cutthroat, yeah.
Yeah.
And
in the end, you're going to get, like, everybody will have, like, built up some kind of fun fantasy character.
Yeah, and
you'd probably, even if you wanted, try and adapt him to a game or something.
Well, that's the thing. At the end of the game, after you've got the final score, everybody sort of gives the tale of their character.
Oh, okay, neat.
It's really fun. Dave, I feel like this game would be 100% up your alley.
I'm 100% sure it would be up
my alley. So we've got more copies of this coming from our alternate distributor. We have one left right at the moment. I am super excited for it. It's maybe my favorite new game I played this year. The other game that I played, Dave, you were part of this, is Detective, a Modern Crime board game.
Yep. This is a game that is not really like anything I've played before.
Yeah, it's closest to something like Time Stories.
Okay, and I would also say, just from what I have read of, I actually still haven't played it yet, but it also felt like one of those Sherlock Holmes games.
Yeah.
Where you are actually tasked to solve a mystery. And you'll be doing things like reading things, finding discrepancies, and doing this. There's a game structure to it, which you can tell us about, Randy. But in the end, it's you and like three or four other people standing around talking in a way, just like you were like somebody in like you know a CSI show or something like that.
Yeah, and that's sort of what this is a high tech CSI kind of thing. You're part of Antares, which is a...
Fictional
crime-fighting unit that's under the auspices of the FBI. Each one of us had a character that was a... Like, one of us was a former psychologist, one was a former cop, and you have little special abilities. And there are five sort of mysteries in there, represented by the deck of cards.
Yep.
And you go through the cards and they tell you things like, here's a lead, do you want to follow this lead? And they tell you, look, some of these leads are dead ends, some of them are just wasting your time, and we had 4 days to do it.
You move abstractly around this board, which has like the police precinct, field work, the lab, and stuff like that. And sometimes when you follow up on one of these leads, it'll tell you that took 2 hours, and you move a little tracker.
Yeah.
So you only have, like, in our case, 4 days to solve something. And, you know, just going around to a few places and interviewing a few people or doing a few lab checks can eat up your time pretty quick for a single day. So you got to be pretty concise.
Yeah, we definitely were chasing down leads we shouldn't have been. And by the time we got to the end, you plug everything into their database. It has a... They have an actual website they use where you can plug in all the names, you get files. Like, it's a really cool immersive
thing. Yeah, the website looks super cool. And, like, this is also a game where they're like, there's actual stuff that they'll want you to know. So, like, this organization came up, and you're supposed to, like, look it up on Wikipedia or whatever you want to do. Like, that is the player's option. And we, like, realized, I mean, if we hadn't looked that stuff up, we would have been clueless on some of those things. Yeah. So you have to do, like, actual real research things.
Yeah. And so at the end, the way they score you is they ask you these questions of like, what did you know, who, and there's multiple choice of like, who did this character do and that kind of thing. And we discovered when we got to the end, that we were terrible detectives.
Yes,
that we had failed at most of the case. We did not get to a big lead until late, like the fourth day. Yeah. And we didn't have time to really pursue it.
Right. And when we got to that lead, it was super cool because there was like something physical to open in the game we hadn't known about.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, it's like, there's a dossier and there's all this kind of cool, neat stuff. It reminded me of when I heard the review team group Shut Up and Sit Down that does video reviews for board games. When they reviewed their Sherlock Holmes game, he talked about how much he loved it, as it was a great game for two people or more, and it was a good game for couples. But he talked about how he's like, this game will not make you feel smart. This game will make you feel dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he really enjoyed the process, and I really enjoyed this game, too.
I did, too, because I felt really dumb.
I thought it had a compelling story.
Yep.
I thought it was well-written. Like, there was some emotional beats in there.
Yeah, there's some great writing to it.
Yeah, like I honestly did. I expected it to be perfunctory and to, like, have neat ideas, but not really anything inspired. But, like, the characters actually have some compelling backstories. There's some interesting red herrings.
Yeah.
There are times when you're like, okay, I don't think this lead is worth following, but I could see it paying off.
But it could be, yeah.
And it's like you make... my brother once told me there's a game reviewer he follows, and that one of his... what do you call it? One of the ways that he judges whether a game is good is whether it has interesting choices in it. Like, you're always making interesting choices. Like, oh, I really want to do this, but I think this might work out a little bit better.
Right.
This is one of those games.
Yeah.
Like, all the directions we went were interesting. We realized some of them were wrong.
Yeah.
But they were still interesting.
It reminds me of Pandemic Legacy when we played it, when we find... It was the first game I played that had sort of plot twists, and this has that, too. It's like a, whoa, did not expect that.
Yeah. It was pretty cool the way things start. The puzzle pieces started to fit together, even if we didn't fill in everything.
Feel like since it is a campaign, there's five different cases.
Yeah,
I feel like, and we know that some of the stuff, like we actually had a couple cards that went into the other cases. We found some overarching plot stuff. I feel like now we have a better sense of it that our case two we might do better, or we might discover we're just really dumb bad detectives.
Yes. That was actually one of the cool things is, like, we know that ultimately there will be connections between some of these cases. And so, like, once or twice we would do something, it would tell us to pull a card out and literally put it in for the next case. So we know that this will have some after effects.
Yeah.
Like, we would go and talk to somebody and they're like, oh, I guess this person knows that we're onto them now or whatever.
Right.
And they're like, that's clearly going to have some effect somewhere down the line. Anyway, it's a pretty exciting game and nothing else like it. If you think you're a badass because you watch some CSI or NCIS or any sort of detective show, or you just like mysteries and stuff like that, for sure check it out.
Yeah. All right, that's it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
Yo Joseph!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.